A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the rental landscape in Israel and noticing something that a lot of people feel in their bones but rarely articulate. The market here is dominated by what you'd call mom and pop landlords, individual owners, maybe one or two properties. And the conventional wisdom is, well, these small-time landlords are often pretty awful. But the question is whether scaling up to corporate, professionally managed landlords actually makes things better for tenants. His instinct was yes. Professionals have experience. They've got contractors on call. They can handle maintenance efficiently. But then a friend told him the reality was the opposite. The contracts were more one-sided, the power imbalance even worse. So the question is, globally, what does the evidence say? When landlords scale up, do tenant rights fare better or worse? And if you had to place a bet on which type is less awful overall, where would you put your money?
This is one of those questions where everyone has a story and almost nobody has looked at the data. And the data is genuinely surprising. Let me start with what the research actually tells us. There was a major study published in the Journal of Urban Economics that looked at exactly this. Tenant satisfaction and complaint rates across different landlord types in the U.S. rental market, which is the most studied market for this. And the finding that jumped out was that institutional landlords, companies with thousands of units, actually had higher formal complaint rates than small landlords. But that's where most people stop reading. The deeper you go, the more interesting it gets.
Higher complaint rates doesn't necessarily mean worse conditions. It could mean tenants actually have someone to complain to.
That's exactly the distinction. Small landlords, the mom and pop types, tend to resolve issues informally. You text them, they come over on Saturday, they fix it, it never enters any record. Institutional landlords have formal complaint systems. Everything is documented. So the raw complaint numbers look worse for the big players, but when you control for reporting behavior, the picture flips.
The metric itself is contaminated by the thing it's measuring.
And this is the first thing most coverage gets wrong. They cite complaint statistics as evidence that corporate landlords are worse, when actually the existence of a functioning complaints mechanism is itself a tenant protection. Your mom-and-pop landlord who never fixes the boiler. There's no paper trail. You have no leverage.
Although the flip side is, the mom-and-pop landlord might actually care that you're cold.
And that's the second layer of this. There was a fascinating study out of the UK from the University of York's Center for Housing Policy that looked at landlord behavior through the lens of what they called relational versus transactional management styles. Small landlords often operate on a relational model. They know you, they might have lived in the unit themselves, there's some social friction to being awful. Corporate landlords are purely transactional. They are optimizing for revenue per unit and you are a line item.
The question becomes whether social friction or professional standards protects you better.
The uncomfortable answer, based on the research, is that it depends entirely on the regulatory environment. In markets with strong tenant protections, Germany, the Netherlands, parts of Canada, institutional landlords are generally better. They comply with regulations, they have maintenance schedules, they know the law, and they follow it because the penalties for non-compliance are meaningful. In markets with weak tenant protections,
they become the final boss of exploitation.
Because now you're not dealing with a slightly clueless individual who owns one flat and doesn't know the law. You're dealing with a legal team that has studied exactly where the gaps are and built their business model inside those gaps.
The friend Daniel mentioned, the one who had a nightmare experience with a commercial landlord, that probably tracks with a weak protections market.
And Israel is a weak protections market. I mean, we've talked about this before. There's no national rent control, lease terms are heavily skewed toward landlords, and enforcement is slow and expensive. In that environment, a corporate landlord, and we're starting to see more of these in Israel, by the way, there are several large firms now aggregating residential units in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. They can be absolutely ruthless.
What does ruthless look like, concretely? I'm imagining something beyond just, they raise my rent.
There was a Reuters piece last year that looked at institutional landlords in several U.S. cities. The playbook is remarkably consistent. Standardized leases that waive as many tenant rights as legally possible. Upfront fees that are structured to be non-refundable. Maintenance request systems designed to create friction. You file a ticket, it gets closed as resolved without anyone visiting, you file again, you give up. And then, at renewal time, they calculate exactly how much it would cost you to move. Movers, deposits, time off work, and they raise the rent to just below that threshold.
They're pricing your inertia.
They're pricing your exhaustion. There's an academic term for this. It's called lock-in exploitation. And institutional landlords are exceptionally good at it because they have the data. They know the average moving cost in that zip code. They know vacancy rates. They know your income bracket from the application you filled out 3 years ago.
The efficiency that sounds good on paper. Contractors at scale. Professional management. That efficiency gets weaponized.
When the incentives align that way, yes. And this is where I want to complicate the picture, because it's not that corporate landlords are inherently worse. It's that, in a regulatory vacuum, their advantages become disadvantages for tenants. The same data infrastructure that could be used to schedule preventive maintenance gets used to optimize rent extraction. The same legal expertise that could ensure fair contracts gets used to write unassailable ones.
So, the global experience, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that the landlord type matters less than the legal framework they're operating within. But given a weak legal framework, which is what Israel has, does the evidence lean one way or the other?
There's a really useful comparison from Ireland, actually. Ireland had a rental market that was predominantly small landlords, very similar to Israel's structure, and they introduced a series of tenant protection reforms starting around 2016. What researchers found was that after the reforms, institutional investors actually became better landlords than the small ones. Because the institutions could absorb the compliance costs, they have compliance departments, while the mom-and-pop landlords often couldn't or wouldn't adapt.
Regulation acts as a filter. It screens out the small landlords who can't hack it and forces the big ones to behave.
Without regulation, you get the worst of both worlds. Small landlords who are inconsistent, unprofessional, sometimes outright neglectful, and large landlords who are predatory in a systematic, optimized way.
If you're a tenant in a weed protections market and you have to choose, what's the actual calculus?
The research suggests, and I'll be careful here because the evidence isn't overwhelming, that in weak protection markets, small landlords are, on average, slightly less awful. And the reason is interesting. Small landlords are more variable. You might get a terrible one. You might get a great one. The distribution is wide. Corporate landlords in weak markets are consistently mediocre to bad. They regress to a mean that is not good.
With a small landlord, you're gambling. With a corporate landlord, you know what you're getting, and what you're getting is bad.
That's the trade-off. And there's a behavioral economics paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research that looked at tenant satisfaction scores across landlord types and found exactly this pattern. The variance for small landlords was enormous. The variance for institutional landlords was narrow and clustered at the lower end of the satisfaction scale.
Which would suggest that if you're the kind of person who can screen a landlord, you know what to ask. You pick up on red flags. The small landlord route gives you a shot at a good outcome that the corporate route simply doesn't offer.
That's the optimistic read. The pessimistic read is that most people can't screen effectively, and the average small landlord in a weak protection market is still not great.
The bet Daniel's asking us to place, which type is less likely to be awful overall? The answer seems to be that it's close, but the median corporate landlord in a weak market is worse than the median small landlord. Even if the very worst small landlords are worse than the very worst corporate ones.
I think that's right. And I want to add one more dimension to this, because there's something that doesn't get talked about enough. A study out of Princeton's eviction lab looked at eviction filing rates by landlord type across several U.S. cities. Institutional landlords file for eviction at significantly higher rates than small landlords. And it's not because their tenants are worse, it's because they have automated the process. The decision to evict isn't made by a human who knows you and might work out a payment plan. It's triggered by an algorithm when your ex stays late.
The compassionless machine.
The thing is, eviction is devastating. It's not just losing your home. It creates a record that makes it harder to rent anywhere else. It can affect your credit, your employment prospects. The institutional landlord externalizes all of those costs onto the tenant and society, while the small landlord might at least feel some weight to the decision.
Even if the small landlord eventually does evict you, the delay itself has value. Time to find something else. Time to negotiate.
And the Princeton data bears this out. The time from missed payment to eviction filing is dramatically shorter for institutional landlords. It's measured in days rather than weeks or months.
We've got complaint systems that create paper trails, but don't necessarily resolve problems. Maintenance systems designed to exhaust you, rent increases calibrated to your moving costs, and algorithmic evictions. This is the efficiency we were promised.
The efficiency is real. It's just pointed in the wrong direction. And this is where I think the policy conversation gets stuck. Because from a housing supply perspective, institutional capital is actually useful. It builds things. It finances construction. The problem isn't the capital, it's the rules of engagement.
Can I push on that a bit? Because I've heard the institutional capital builds things argument before, and I wonder if it overstates the case. In a lot of markets, what institutional capital actually does is buy existing housing stock and convert it to rentals. They're not adding units. They're just changing who owns them.
That's a completely fair push. The distinction is between what economists call greenfield investment, building new housing, and brownfield acquisition, buying what already exists. And you're right that a lot of the corporate aggregation we're seeing, especially in Israel, is brownfield. It's firms buying individual condo units and assembling rental portfolios. That doesn't add a single unit of housing to the market. It just centralizes ownership.
The supply argument is a bit of a bait and switch. They claim they're solving the housing crisis, but they're actually just capturing a larger share of the existing pie.
In many cases, yes. The greenfield stuff, the build-to-rent developments, those add supply. But the brownfield aggregation model, which is what's currently happening in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, is purely about market share. And when you concentrate market share without adding supply, you get pricing power without any offsetting social benefit.
Which circles back to the lock-in exploitation you mentioned. If a company owns enough units in the neighborhood, they don't just know your moving costs, they control your alternatives.
And that's a whole other layer of the problem that the research has only started to grapple with. Market concentration in rental housing. When one landlord owns a significant fraction of the available units in a given area, the whole, just move if you don't like it, advice stops making sense. Because you might be moving to another unit owned by the same company.
The power asymmetry isn't just landlord versus tenant. It's landlord versus an entire neighborhood's worth of tenants, with the landlord holding more information and more options.
And that's the direction several Israeli cities are heading, by the way. The aggregation trend isn't theoretical, it's happening right now, and the regulatory framework hasn't caught up.
If someone is listening to this and they're in a market like Israel's, and they're trying to decide between renting from an individual versus a company, what's the concrete advice?
I'd say there are a few things to look for. One, read the lease. I know everyone says this, but with corporate landlords, the lease is the entire relationship. If the lease has an asymmetric renewal clause, something that lets them raise rent by an unspecified amount but locks you in, that's a red flag. Two, check if there's a formal maintenance system and, critically, ask other tenants how responsive it actually is. Don't ask the leasing agent. Find someone in the elevator.
The elevator test.
The elevator test is underrated. Three, look at the ownership structure. Some corporate landlords are publicly traded REITs. Their fiduciary duty is to shareholders, not tenants. They are legally obligated to maximize returns. A privately held company or a nonprofit housing association has different incentives.
For small landlords?
Ask why they're renting the property. If they inherited it and have no idea what they're doing, that can go either way. They might be neglectful or they might be grateful for the income and treat you well. If they're a deliberate investor who owns multiple properties, they're basically a small corporate landlord without the compliance infrastructure. That's often the worst of both worlds.
The amateur professional.
The dilettante slumlord. It's a whole category.
Can we linger on that category for a second? Because I think that's actually the most common type in Israel. Not the single unit inheritor and not the institutional aggregator, but the person who owns three or four units as their retirement plan. What does the evidence say about that middle tier?
and the research on that specific segment is thinner than I'd like. But what we do have suggests they combine the worst traits of both extremes. They have enough units that they don't have a personal relationship with each tenant, so the social friction is gone. But they don't have enough scale to justify professional management. So you get the informality of the small landlord without the accountability, and the profit-maximizing mindset of the corporate landlord without the systems.
They're running a business, but treating it like a hobby.
The tenant is caught in the gap. The landlord says, "I'm just a small investor. Don't expect hotel service." But they also say, "This is my retirement. I can't afford to give you a break on the rent." They shift between the two frames depending on what's convenient in the moment.
I've definitely met that landlord. The one who's a humble pensioner when you ask for repairs, and a hard-nosed business person when the rent is due.
It's a classic heads I win tails, you lose dynamic. And because they're small enough to fly under the regulatory radar but large enough to cause real harm, they're particularly difficult to deal with from a policy perspective.
We've established that in wheat protection markets, the deck is stacked either way. But if you force me to place a bet, I'd lean toward the small landlord simply because the variance gives you a chance. The corporate landlord in a weak market has already optimized for your misery.
I think that's where I land too. But I want to add a caveat, because there's a scenario where corporate landlords actually improve things even in weak markets, and we're starting to see it in some places. When institutional landlords enter a market at scale, they become a political constituency. 1,000 individual landlords don't have a lobbying arm. A company with 10,000 units does. And sometimes, that lobbying goes in directions that benefit tenants. Not out of altruism, but because stable, predictable regulation is better for their business model than chaos.
They push for clarity, and clarity happens to help tenants too.
In some cases. Standardized lease templates, clear maintenance obligations, defined renewal processes. These are things that institutional landlords can work with and that also protect tenants. The danger is when they push for clarity that only protects them.
The devil's in the drafting.
And this is actually happening in Israel right now. There's been a push, mostly from larger real estate firms, for a standardized national lease framework. The motivation is partly self-serving. They want predictability. But if it results in clearer tenant rights, that's a net positive.
Although I'd be skeptical that the current political environment produces a framework that's tenant-friendly.
As would I. But the dynamic is worth watching. The entry of institutional capital changes the political economy of rental housing in ways that can cut both directions.
How does that work in practice, though? The lobbying part. Because I can imagine a large landlord pushing for standardization, that looks good on the surface. We support clear, transparent leases for all Israeli renters, but buried in the fine print are provisions that systematically favor the party with the legal team. How do you distinguish between genuine standardization and regulatory capture?
That's the central challenge, and honestly, it's incredibly difficult to do in real time. You usually only know in retrospect, but there are a few tells. One is whether the proposed framework includes mandatory dispute resolution mechanisms that are accessible to tenants. Not just courts, but something like a rental tribunal that doesn't require a lawyer. If the industry fights that, it's a red flag. Another is whether the framework caps what can be in the lease, or just standardizes the language. Standardized language without substantive limits is just a prettier cage.
The question to ask is, does this framework create new rights? Or just organize existing power relations more efficiently.
And the Israeli proposals I've seen so far are heavy on organization and light on new rights.
To pull this together, the global evidence says that landlord type matters less than the regulatory environment. But in the specific context of weak protections, small landlords are probably the less bad bet. The friend Daniel mentioned who had a worse experience with a commercial landlord. That's consistent with the pattern we'd expect in a market like Israel's. And the broader lesson is that the problem isn't really about landlord personality or scale. It's about the rules.
A strong law with no enforcement is just a suggestion. Israel has some tenant protections on the books, but the enforcement mechanism is essentially the courts, which are slow and expensive. Most tenants don't have the resources to pursue a claim. So the protections exist in theory and evaporate in practice.
Which brings us back to the power asymmetry. The whole rental relationship is defined by who can afford to wait, who can afford to fight, and who has more to lose. Scale just amplifies whatever asymmetry already exists.
That's the cleanest summary, I think. If the asymmetry favors landlords, scale makes it worse. If regulations balance the asymmetry, scale can actually make things better because it brings professionalism and accountability. The variable isn't the size of the landlord. It's the size of the tenant's leverage.
In Israel, the tenant's leverage is approximately zero.
It's not zero, but it's thin. There are some tenant advocacy groups that have emerged in the last few years. There's been more media coverage of rental issues. The conversation is shifting. But structurally, yeah, it's a landlord's market and everyone knows it.
If Daniel's asking me where I'd place my bet, I'm betting on the small landlord, but I'm not happy about it. It's the lesser of two weevils.
Did you just say weevils? That's not the expression.
I know what I said.
Lesser of two weevils. There's one more angle I want to touch on, which is the build-to-rent sector. This is a relatively new phenomenon, mostly in the US and UK, where companies build entire developments specifically to rent, not to sell. They're the landlord from day one. And the early evidence on tenant satisfaction in build-to-rent is actually more positive than for converted properties.
Why would that be?
Because the building was designed for renting. The maintenance infrastructure is built in. The units are standardized, which makes repairs faster. The common areas are managed. It's a fundamentally different product than a condo some investor bought and rented out.
It's the difference between a car designed as an EV from the ground up versus a gasoline car someone shoved a battery into.
And build-to-rent operators have a longer time horizon. They're not flipping the building, they're planning to own it for decades. That changes the maintenance calculus. Deferred maintenance costs more in the long run, and they know it.
Is build-to-rent happening in Israel?
Very early stages. There are a couple of projects in the planning phase, mostly in the Tel Aviv metro area, but it's not yet a meaningful part of the market, and given land prices and zoning, it may be a while before it is.
For the foreseeable future, the choice in Israel remains between individual owners and the kind of corporate aggregation where someone buys up a bunch of existing units and rents them out.
And that aggregation model is the one that tends to produce the worst outcomes, because the business plan is basically acquire units, minimize costs, maximize rents, extract value. There's no long-term investment in the property or the tenants.
The strip mining approach to housing.
That's a grim way to put it, but not inaccurate.
So, if we were to give someone a checklist for navigating this, what would be on it?
First, know the law. Even in a weak protection market, there are things a landlord can't legally do. In Israel, for example, there are restrictions on how much and how often rent can be increased during a lease term. If you don't know your rights, you can't assert them. Second, document everything. Every interaction, every payment, every repair request. If you're dealing with a small landlord, the relationship is informal, and that can work in your favor, but it can also work against you if things go south. Third, and this is the uncomfortable one, be willing to walk away.
Which is hard in a tight market.
It's incredibly hard, but the willingness to walk is the only real leverage a tenant has in a market like Israel's. If the landlord knows you won't leave, they have no incentive to accommodate you.
It's the same dynamic as any negotiation. The party that can walk away has the power.
In rental markets, the tenant almost never can walk away easily. That's the structural problem. Everything else flows from that.
We've covered the global evidence, the regulatory context, the variance question, the build-to-rent exception, and the practical advice. I think the core answer to the prompt is, in a weak protection market like Israel's, bet on the small landlord, but only because the alternative is consistently bad. The real fix isn't about choosing your landlord type. It's about changing the rules.
I'd add, don't romanticize the small landlord. The data doesn't say they're good. It says they're less predictably bad. That's a low bar.
It's a bar so low, it's basically a tripping hazard.
Welcome to rental housing in 2026.
Before we wrap, there's one thing I want to flag. The prompt mentioned a sentiment that landlords in Israel are generally awful, and that this is entirely true. I want to push back on that just slightly. Not because I think landlords are wonderful, I don't, but because blanket statements like that can obscure the actual dynamics. There are good landlords in Israel, There are landlords who charge below market rent because they value stable tenants. There are landlords who fix things promptly. The problem is that the system doesn't incentivize any of that behavior. So the good landlords are good despite the system, not because of it.
That's a fair point, and it connects to something I've been thinking about. When we say landlords are awful, we're often describing the incentives, not the people. A person who might be perfectly decent in other contexts becomes a nightmare when they're in a position of unchecked power over someone else's housing. The situation corrupts.
Unchecked power corrupts uncheckedly.
Is that a word?
It is now. 8!
But the principle stands, and this is why I keep coming back to regulation. Not because regulation is a magic wand, but because it's the only thing that changes the incentives. You can't rely on the goodness of individual landlords, whether they're mom-and-pop owners or corporate executives. You have to structure the system so that even a selfish actor behaves decently.
The design, the system for the worst actor principle.
And right now, Israel's rental system is designed as if all actors are good ones. There are few enforcement mechanisms because the assumption is that disputes will be resolved amicably. But when they're not, the tenant has almost no recourse.
The recommendation, if we were to make one, is not choose a small landlord over a corporate one. It's push for a regulatory framework that makes both types behave better.
In the meantime, if you have to choose, know what you're choosing. A small landlord might be your neighbor. A corporate landlord will never be your neighbor. That fact alone shapes behavior in ways that all the contracts in the world can't fully capture.
The neighbor effect. It's real, even if it's not reliable.
It's not reliable, but it's not nothing. I think about the landlord I had in graduate school, an older woman who lived 2 floors down. She wasn't a great landlord in the professional sense. She didn't have a maintenance schedule. But she knew my name, she knew my partner's name, she knew when we were sick because she'd see us less often in the stairwell. That kind of proximity creates a social cost to being awful that no lease clause can replicate.
The flip side is the neighbor who's also your landlord and decides they don't like your cooking smells or the hours you keep. Proximity cuts both ways.
I had a colleague whose landlord lived upstairs and treated every noise as a personal affront. The relationship became suffocating, so the neighbor effect is a double-edged sword, which is kind of the theme of this whole conversation. Nothing is purely good or purely bad. It all depends on context, incentives, and the specific humans involved.
Which is maybe the most honest answer to the prompt. It depends is unsatisfying, but it's also true.
It depends is the motto of every honest researcher. We should put it on a mug.
We'd sell dozens. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1850, a shipment of nutmeg bound for England was accidentally routed through Labrador due to a navigational error. The crew, unaware of where they were, attempted to trade the nutmeg with local Inuit communities, who had no use for it, and reportedly used the spice as a form of improvised currency in barter with other European ships for the next 3 years. For a brief window, nutmeg was more valuable than beaver pelts in parts of coastal Labrador, a fact that almost certainly would have altered the spice trade if anyone in charge had actually noticed.
Somewhere there's an alternate history, where Labrador is the nutmeg capital of the world.
The Labrador Nutmeg Exchange. I'd visit.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.